This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, and welcome back to New Books in Eastern European Studies. I'm your host, Piotr Kruszycki. I'm professor of history at the University of Maryland in College Park. I'm very pleased today to welcome Dr. Jochen Lingelbach to the program. Dr. Jochen Lingelbach is a postdoctoral research fellow in African history at the University of Bayreuth in Germany, working in the project Africa in the Global History of Refugee Camps, 1940s, 1950s, within the university's Africa Multiple Reconfiguring African Studies Cluster of Excellence. His research interests include the modern history of East Africa, colonialism, forced migration, and on a general level, the manifold historical entanglements of people, things, and ideas created through human mobility around the globe. He obtained his doctorate at the African Studies Institute of the University of Leipzig. And we will be discussing today his book that appeared in 2020 with Berghahn Books, entitled On the Edges of Whiteness, Polish Refugees in British Colonial Africa During and After the Second World War. Dr. Lingelbach, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Piotr. Thank you so much for inviting me here and for this nice introduction. Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you here. I like the fact that you work at the crossing of so many different fields, and I think that may frame my first question to you, which is, it's a rarity for me to host on New Books in Eastern European Studies a trained Africanist. How did you as an Africanist come to write a book about Eastern Europeans?
Actually, quite by accident. It was in the course of my master's thesis. I did it in Dar es Salaam, on the colonial history of the town of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. And then I was interviewing old people in town just to ask them, okay, how was it back then? People who remembered the late colonial times. So asking who did live where in town. So, and then one old man just said like, yeah, and then there were some Polish refugees there. And I was like, okay, now I think it couldn't be right. And then he said like, no, they were from Poland. That was during the war, they fled there. And so like, okay, no one ever heard about this. And then I asked more people and started to do some little research. And then I was just like fascinated by the story. And I thought that there was nothing written on it. Actually, there's quite some literature, but not so much. And yeah, that piqued my interest. And then I just followed up on this. And then I started learning Polish. And yeah, because before that, I had no idea about Polish history. I mean, I know some German history as I'm from Germany. But yeah. The rest was more my interest was more from the colonial history side, East African history.
Well, so you actually bring multiple axes into frame the story at the very start of the book. I think you describe them as exile, immigration and colonial histories. And I think you do a beautiful job, actually, of really entangling those different frameworks. I'm curious, just to sort of help the readers who aren't familiar, or rather the listeners who aren't familiar yet with your book, how do colonial history and exile history come together in your research?
I mean, I do this a bit in reviewing the literature that's there already on this. So there's I guess most of the literature is from Polish exile history, like people from Poland writing about Polish refugees because they were from Poland. Then there are other works of people from Canada, Australia, who trace the groups of people who came to this history and then to these countries. And then there are some who write on colonial history, but not so much yet, who write about the history of the host countries of in Tanzanian history, Ugandan history, Kenyan history, and so on. So, and I think it all comes together there because it's on the same side, same moment. It's history of people in exile from Poland. But at the same time, it something happens in the colonies when this large group of people comes in there of European refugees, and then they have to somehow be brought into this colonial society.
Well, so to help situate our audience, we're talking about, if I get the numbers right from your book, slightly over 19,000 refugees, of whom I understand about 2/3 eventually would settle in the United Kingdom. But over the span of 5 to 8 years, I guess it depends exactly for whom we're counting and where, are distributed across Eastern and Central Africa. Although South Africa also plays a role in your story. And the scale is very different depending which spaces we're talking about. And I think obviously for Africanists, there's going to be a lot to engage here also about why Tanganyika or Uganda ended up absorbing so many more refugees than the Rhodesias, or especially compared to Kenya or South Africa. But let's say for a cross-field audience, what would you say is maybe the most important starting point to tell the story of Poles coming for a temporary stay in Africa in the middle of the Second World War?
I mean, first of all, the first question I always get is how did they end up there? So that's always the first point I have to make, or before going into this. So and that's a bit of a complicated story because they were first deported to the Soviet Union and then released later and then transferred there. But maybe I'm not going into detail there. I think what strikes many people as well, or what I think is important is the one thing that, if you put it into wider refugee history, is that it's like the common assumption today is like people are fleeing from Africa to Europe. That's like what most people think about when you say like Europe, Africa, and refugees. Then it's mostly about refugees from Africa to Europe. But I think that's one of the key takeaway stories, that okay, some time ago it was the other way around. So, and again, today with the whole refugee movement from Ukraine, this is coming up again. So, but then the other point I think worth making is that it's every refugee history is not, every specific episode has a particular context. So it's not like any refugee moving from everywhere is always treated the same, but it's really depends on where do people come from and how they are categorized.
This is one of the major, I think, points in your book, as I read it, that Poles were Europeans, clearly, but in some ways they were barely Europeans. You use a variety of different terms to describe their standing. And obviously, we're talking above all about the perspective of colonial administrations, broadly framed and financed and run from Britain, but not exclusively. We're also talking about local African perspectives, that they were poor whites, that they were liminal whites. I think one phrase that really stayed in my memory from the colonial administrators, peasants out of place. But these are actually very different conversations potentially, right? So if we're thinking about the Poles who, via the Soviet Union, via Iran, ultimately ended up, at least for a few years, in these displaced person camps in Africa, are we thinking of them as points of racial contrast that had the potential to shake things up for the colonial power structure and social structure? Are we thinking about them in class terms or in economic terms relative, or if we want to use a term that I really can't stand, civilizational terms within European social structures and hierarchies? I guess in some sense, the answer is all of the above. But now that you've finished the book, and it's been a while since you published the book, I'm curious, what stays with you? Is it really a story that requires being told through the lens of race? Is class helpful? What are the right frameworks for thinking about Polish exiles in Africa?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, as you said, I would definitely say, okay, all of this is important and it intersects. So I think on the basis there's an intersectional perspective, because like these people were privileged by whiteness. They were, on the other hand, they were marginalized in the view of the British administrators. They were Eastern Europeans. They were Eastern Europeans, and then they were peasants. So there's class coming in, but not all. Again, then if you really go into the sources, into the details, then you have a group where you have some former civil servants, highly educated, who could speak English, and then they were quite underlining their own Europeanness and their civilizational, as you put the word, their class, underlining their class there, and then you have other Poles who could not play in this field because they were clearly from the rural periphery of the deepest Eastern Poland. So so I think all of this comes in there. At least what I did with my title, and I think also with my, because I'm mainly focusing on colonial history, so that's my where I come from. That's why I think in colonial societies, racism is the most important basic marker of difference. So that's why I think this is of utmost importance. But I think the other points are also important. So and also gender plays an important role. That these refugees were mainly women and children does play a role, definitely. So yeah, somehow all of the above. But I would say, okay, maybe I would put race in the center, or at least that's why I did. I mean, there are different ways to write the same story that would definitely put other emphasis here, but yeah.
Yeah, I was put in mind, I think, about midway through the book of a book from the field of U.S. immigration history, which I think you reference in your study, Matthew Jacobson's Whiteness of a Different Color. And I am wondering, I mean, obviously, I read that book some time ago and in a completely different context, but it's striking whether we're talking about the Poles in Africa or the Poles as they were understood by European colonizers from other European countries. In this case, we're talking about Britain above all. Does it make sense to think in terms of race and racism within the category of whiteness. And in this sense, you know, I think it's that's an element of the story of Polish expulsion and displacement and refugees from World War II that maybe hasn't quite been investigated quite so much compared to how the British or the French would saw their colonial populations overseas.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, most definitely. I think there are differences, and it's always relational. If the same person from Eastern Poland would end up at the same time end up in Britain as a refugee, would be very clear at the bottom of the social hierarchy. But in the colonies, it was different. So they were still at the bottom of the white society, but not at the bottom of society, of colonial society as a whole. So I think it's always relational. But I think, yeah, as you said, it's really important to say that white society is not a monolithic block. It's not homogeneous. That's what I learned from this story, and that what piqued my interest in the beginning. Also, that to say, okay, usually there's this schematic image of colonial society where you have the white powerful oppressor, and then you have the black powerless oppressed, and then a group of poor white refugees comes in there, and then it was like, okay, so what's now with them? They didn't even choose to go there. They didn't want to go there. So actually, they were afraid to go there. But then they were there in the end. So, and I think it's important to distinguish between what a colonial discourse an idea of a colonial society that is important and powerful and plays out, but in the end, the historical reality is quite messy. So, and also that's what Anne Laura Stoll and other colonial history historians make an important point, is that then the difference between white and black is not so clear cut, and not always so clear. But there are these people on the borders sitting there who are somehow not quite white, as you said, yeah, Jacobson. So.
Well, in your story, as you mentioned, gender is a structuring force in this story. And if we're talking mostly about Polish women and children, then these women were encountering men and women, but above all men, from a variety of different groups. And in that sense, like you said, the binary collapses quite quickly, because we're not just talking black-white story here. We're talking about non-British Europeans. Italians come up a lot in your story. Likewise, Indians, Seychellois. So there is a mix. Even, I think, making it complicated to disaggregate on the receiving end or the host end, so to speak. And then it strikes me also, coming from Eastern Europe, and I think this is a very important conversation in the book, and it's one that I wanted to make sure to highlight for our audience. You also talk about how differences back in Poland, from Polish territory, between identities based on religion and nationality. Anti-Semitism is the central example, but also Belarusians and Ukrainians who were expelled and ended up as refugees in Africa. So obviously, this is a lot of complexity. Are there lessons for each of these cases that you would take away? Do you feel like, let's say, a scholar of Indians in Africa or a scholar of the Holocaust can read your book and think about the way these different groups entangled?
Yeah, that's a complex, complex question from many aspects. Let me just pick out maybe one. That's anti-Semitism among the group. It was mainly a Christian Catholic group, but there were some Jewish Poles as well among them, and some Orthodox former Polish citizens who would identify as Ukrainians or Belarusians. So it's the majority were Catholic Poles, but not all. So, and the question of anti-Semitism is, especially at the time and in the post-war period in Poland, it's a contested topic. And in my sources, what I came across was there were some reports of that there was anti-Semitism among them, but then there was one story where the Jewish congregation in Nairobi, they heard about there are some Jews among the Polish refugees, so then they sent actually Jewish congregation member from South Africa who toured the camps to see, okay, how are they faring? Because they heard like, okay, maybe it's not good. But then he went around and what he said, like, they are okay there. They are not complaining. And then this Nairobi congregation helped with building a synagogue in one of the northern Tanganyikan refugee camps. So it's quite a harmonic picture. But on the other hand, there are reports where anti-Semitism was there. So I really had what I was writing, there's no clear answer again. So to say like, okay, I guess there were anti-Semites and there were people who just went along well. But there were many, there were also other conflicts. There were also people among the refugees who were pro-communist. Very few, but they were there. So there were all the different social or political groupings that came to the colonies were still there. So especially in the larger camps where you speak like Tengeru, there were like over 4,000 people. It was like a massive town or small town with all the Polish social life in there. So there were also all the conflicts coming up there.
I think that this is—it's quite clearly told from a lot of different angles in your book. It strikes me, okay, there were choices made at various levels, especially by the Brits, but also by the colonial authorities on the ground, whether or not to let folks in. And early in your book, you describe several specific cases in which the colonial authorities are rejecting Jews, especially in the 1930s. And on the other hand, once the group was welcomed as such, and obviously, you know, there's a piece of context you give, I think, very well in the book. This is a group that was attached to the Polish army that was serving alongside the Brits after 1941. And in that sense, if Jews were fighting in the army, then their families were entitled to be part of this larger refugee group that was resettled at Britain's cost. So the question then, I mean, it strikes me that you get these cases. Julian Zamenhof comes up a couple times in your book, and folks who don't know Polish history so well in the audience might not recognize the name Zamenhof. His uncle was the creator of the Esperanto language, but an assimilated Polish Jewish family. And he ended up, from what you said, doing quite well and ultimately moving on to the UK and living relatively comfortably in the UK after moving on from Africa. Was he a rare success story, or is that, was that a possible horizon line for this path?
Mm-hmm. I think with Julian Zamenhof, he was, I think here class clearly strikes everything else. So because it was an upper class family, highly educated, he was a doctor. So yeah, he was quite respected by the British officials. So I think that's in this case. So these are the rare cases where you have like these highly educated people of a certain class who then, yeah, can go on. Anyway, so the other point you raised is the connection to the British Army and the whole rationale. Why did they come there? Why were they accepted there? They were connected to the British Army, and so there was on the highest strategic level in Britain, there was an interest to have these people somehow somewhere safe and well cared for. So in order to have the army fighting with the Brits at a time in 1941 where the end of the war was not clear at all, so there was it was a critical point. So that's and as you said, like the former rejection of Jewish refugees from Central Europe, they were rejected by the British. They were rejected nearly everywhere. So that's all this sad story before the war, before 1939. And they were also rejected in the colonies in Kenya. And there were many, but there was no strategic interest in these people. They were just like Jewish people fleeing the war. And okay, then there was anti-Semitism. Definitely, and there was this fear, okay, these people come, but they don't have a nationality anymore. They are stateless because they left Germany, and Germany, Nazis took away their citizenship. So there was this strong urge against. But this was all trumped by this rationale to, okay, we need, by this strategic interest. And then the local government in the colonies were just, more or less, okay, they had to contribute to save the empire. So there was, and that's also one of the reasons, I think, among others, that especially Uganda and Tanganyika took in most of the refugees, because they hadn't contributed so much already. Like Kenya, where there were less, in Kenya there were, it was important military hub, and there were prisoners of war. That also what you said earlier, the Italians, many of them were former prisoners of war. So there were many men, they were all Catholics. So it's no coincidence that they met then. So,
It strikes me that, of course, there are so many contrasts in this story. So even though we're talking, I think the figure you gave was roughly 80% women and children for the group, or even more. But in that sense, Kenya, right? Because the Nairobi, there was a phrase that came up in your book, that Nairobi as a capital of Polish Africa, but that was not the representative experience at all. There was a Polish refugee, let's call it a public sphere, right? There were printed newspapers and bulletins, a lot of them connected to religious life and Catholic chaplaincy. There was the actual Polish language administration, initially at least, until its derecognition, run on behalf of the Polish government in exile, the London-based government. But then most of these refugees were poor women and children from the Eastern Kresy of interwar Poland, whose homeland stopped being sovereign Polish territory in the course of the time that they were in Africa. And the dilemmas that they faced, I found really just really quite strikingly portrayed in your book. I don't know if you might just want to say a few words about the kinds of choices and also the way those choices changed in the course of the years that especially these poor women, whether they were widows with children or single or widows without children, faced.
I think in the beginning or during wartime, everyone was expecting to go back. There was all the time the idea that was held up. And as you said, these people were, through the army, closely connected to the London exile government. And this government definitely thought, okay, after the war, we go back. So we are in exile, we go back. So just a matter of time till we won. But then the end of the war turned out differently. So there was a communist government installed there. So they were somehow stuck. And they didn't really know where to go now, what to do now. Especially the government wanted to have these people together and keep them Polish and just wait till they can come back. I mean, in the first post-war years, it was not all was clear. It was all in flux still, or like as we see from today. Okay, we know it took until the 80s, 90s. So, but that was not the time horizon back then. People thought like, okay, maybe we will come back and everything will be fine. So eventually didn't know, not. And so the people in the refugee camps were waiting, and they were, I guess, they were mobilizing people who already had some relatives somewhere, tried to get to them, like very naturally, like refugees everywhere and every time. They tried to go there where they know already people and where it's safe. So especially if you look at the there was a massive labor migration before from Poland to like from all of Europe to North America. So many people knew someone there, and then they tried to get there, have some uncle in America where they could go. And then others, just with the passing of time, I mean, they stayed there. 1948, like 2/3 of them were allowed to go to Britain, but some stayed even until 1950. So there was nearly 5 years they were sitting there and trying to get anywhere. So, and there were some people also just wanted to stay where they were. They said like, okay, no, it's fine here. I can stay in Tanzania. It's a nice place here. It's what I know, and it's peace. Some had contact, some spoke local languages, had contact with people from around. So, but then they were not left. Then they were, after the war, there were also discussions, because then the UN refugee organizations that came in, the International Refugee Organization, IRO, they wanted to settle the people anywhere. So they also asked the local government, could you not just take them where they are, like asking the colonial government in Uganda and Tanganyika. But then they said like, no, we don't want them here. So we took them for the time of the war, but now they have to go. It's really responsibility of the British government. So
yeah, I it strikes me also that the story of shifting responsibility as the international political context change. And obviously there's another piece of that puzzle, which is that all this time, these are refugees originating in their refugee experience from expulsion by the Soviet Union. But of course, the Soviet Union was the wartime ally of the Brits. So there's this sleight of hand playing itself out in terms of the public framing and the story that's also being told, I think, to the refugees. But after the war ended, there was the striking difference I found. I got the sense you're fairly critical of the IRO. You can tell me in a second if I read you right or not. But certainly, Polish women in the African camps seemed really, really worried about the IRO's predecessor, the UN Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, also known as UNRRA, simply put, because they were afraid they'd be forced to go back to Poland, but not their Poland, a Soviet-dominated Poland. And it seemed that that was a window where maybe it was a threat, a menace that was looming, and then somehow things got a little bit better. You said a moment ago that the IRO just wanted to put them somewhere, anywhere, not necessarily send them back home. But how... if you think from the standpoint of the actual fear experienced or the desires experienced by and the choices forced on as a consequence the refugees, how real was that prospect of being forced to go to a communist version of their homeland?
I mean, it's difficult to say how what could have played out differently. But I mean, there has some parallels to the European displaced persons history. So where UNRRA, like UN Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, was mainly taken care of. And they were involved in forced repatriations to the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union, the whole Eastern Bloc, was part of UNRWA as well. So that's also the main difference between UNRWA and IRO, because IRO was the direct successor of UNRWA. But the Eastern Bloc was not part of it anymore. So I think this fear was definitely there. I mean, they had been deported before, and UNRWA was the main means of UNRWA to bring people. Let me start differently. UNRWA was set up to take care of displaced persons, refugees who were stuck in Europe mainly, but also in these poles. But the only thing that they could offer to settle them somewhere else was repatriation. So they were registering them. So there came a mission from UNRWA to the East African camps, and they wanted to register them. But the people in the camps, especially informed by the Polish elites and Polish officials connected to the London government, who were strictly against any repatriation to communist Poland, they were saying like, okay, don't sign anything, because then they send you back. So there was a massive fear. So when this UNRWA official came to Tengeru in northern Tanganyika, people threatened him. They threw tomatoes, and so he was really. There was one observer who said, "Like, okay, I was surprised he wasn't harmed there." So it was really a tense situation where people were really afraid to be forcefully sent back. So I think it was a very real fear. If it could have happened, I don't know. I mean, that's guessing how history could have developed. So, but it was definitely a very tangible feel of people who had been deported earlier, had lived in labor camps and special settlement in the Soviet Union and had suffered there. So they were definitely afraid, although some voluntarily went back to Poland. So
eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Well, you give a number of examples that of the kinds of choices that women especially faced. I mean, again, keeping in mind the demographics of the refugee population we're talking about, partly to avoid repatriation, but also maybe to avoid the uncertainty of other types of displacement. It seemed obviously this it's hard to judge scale given the available source base, but it seemed that a substantial number of these female refugees sought social ties that would keep them, or at least would give them a specific way out. You talk about marriages that sometimes turn out to be bigamous, to the profound detriment of the refugee women who entered into them. You talk also about the sort of fraught inter-ethnic and interracial questions attached to that. Keeping in mind, of course, I'm talking to our audience here, that the colonial governments didn't want, for the most part, these refugees to stay. So because of the fear, because of the uncertainty you just described, what kind of choices did refugee women make, especially once the war had ended?
I mean, especially those who didn't have any man in the army or close connections somewhere else. They were quite. I think there's to give at least some numbers that I found, but it's always sketchy. So there were like I think 200 Polish women who married, and I think it were mainly British residents in the colony. So, and I think there again to come back to an earlier question. On the question of where they were situated in the colonial society, I think when a woman then married a British resident, then there you have this where gender and race come together and nationality come together, because then they become like a British woman. So if they behave like they should, then it's like, okay, then they change the name, and then that's also where I tried to trace some people, then I couldn't find them anymore, but because then their name changed and then I didn't know. So but then they become part of this proper white British society. Others try to, they come up not very often, because somehow it's just the sources are sketchy and they are scattered. And but then there are some stories, like this one woman who married an assumedly Indian man in Uganda and tried to stay there, although she had the prospect of going to Britain or even going to Australia, I think. So, but she said like, no. She changed to the Muslim faith, to not be reliant on a Catholic priest. Because then the Catholic priest would maybe say, "No, I'm not. You won't get married here." So, but then she assumed the Muslim faith, and then she could marry. And then the Catholic authorities and the British authorities couldn't really say anything anymore. They really didn't like that. That's what I from this one case, because it came up in the files. But so there's a variety of possible choices to be made. I mean, yeah, although the largest majority went then first in because most went to Britain, as you said already, and that was connected first. The people could go who had relatives in the army, because the Polish army was demobilized and then settled in Britain, and all of the Polish refugees who had a direct relative in the army could go there. And then in a second round of discussions and debates between the colonial governments and the British government, they said they widened the scope. Okay, there are other people who don't have an uncle in the army, they can still come here. So, but all the time there was a fear that okay, maybe we could not go there. And then there were other people who were excluded when they had. Out of medical reasons or security reasons, people who they were like the really last people still in the camps were the ones who had maybe a criminal record, or they had a disease or any other thing that made them ineligible from the British Home Office point of view.
From what I remember from your book, a lot of those people ultimately ended up in the UK anyway, just because the formerly colonial governments under decolonization just kind of threw them out.
That were these last maybe, I think, 10 or 20 people who were then still there until in Tanganyika until independence. So, yeah.
Well, in terms of the scale, obviously, you know, we're talking, and I actually want to ask you a little bit more about sources in just a moment, but the example you gave of the Polish woman who converted to Islam in order to sidestep various restrictions, whether religious or cultural or legal, in terms of what her choices would be, I gather that that was a fairly exceptional case. However, you talk about a broader phenomenon, both in terms of kind of violation of social and cultural norms and serious legal questions, especially from the standpoint of the colonial governments, and that's interracial sex, sexuality, just more generally in terms of the encounters between, let's say, African workers in and around the camps and female refugees. And then also the longer term question, which is marriage and family, interracial marriage and family. So I'm curious, I know this maybe sort of bleeds over more into the African history side of the conversation, but to what extent did actually the Polish female refugees, did their story impact those norms and impact and challenge or complicate some of those race mixing prejudices and forced changes?
I think especially in Southern Rhodesia, that is Zimbabwe today, there was very strong fear because there was a strong, large white settler community, was very aware that they were still a minority in power, and they very much insisted on the social distancing between black and white. So, and then there was the case of some few of the Polish women who had interracial sex with African men, and they were really concerned about it. It's like this, it went to the heart of this distinction. That's also what I said, like this, it's so important for a colonial society to work to keep up this distance there. And in the moment where people come in, and then this boundary get blurred. So there was really a threat to the stability of the at least perceived stability. In the end, I think it doesn't shake the whole system, but this fear on the side of the white settlers was very pronounced, and also white women settler communities who were very like in white women welfare organizations in Southern Rhodesia, they were very much concerned about these young white women who have sex with anyone. So that's in their view. I mean, that's. I think in. And on the other side, the male authorities in the Polish camps of the refugees. I mean, there were still some men, and they were usually in the position of power. So they were the camp leaders, the internal camp leaders. They were also very concerned if they heard about anyone who had contact, because they wanted. I mean, that's in all that connects to also to other group discourses where the gendered role of women as the keeper of the community, when they transgress the boundaries of this group. Be it a national group or a religious group or a racially defined group, then it's always a threat to the whole community. So, and it's very different because interracial sexuality in colonies, if it involved white men and black women, it was not such a big issue. I mean, it was also an issue, but not in the same amount. There's quite a difference. quite a different effect depending on who has intercourse with whom. So
it strikes me that there's clearly a biopolitics in play here, and of course, what it looks like will depend whom exactly we're discussing. But the question of sex, sexuality, and its implications for these race categories actually takes me back to one of the points with which we started, I would think, where you talk about the liminal whiteness of Poles, and it strikes me maybe that I would be interested in teasing out a little bit more what you think the implications were longer term, in the sense that you think that that had maybe the most... I'll give a few different options, but you can feel free to choose none of them. I want to hear what you think. The implications were for the Polish refugees as they moved on to their ultimate destinations in terms of how they understood themselves. In other words, the experience of having been refugees in Africa and wrestled with these questions. Were there consequences for the colonial governments? Right. I mean, obviously, this is the sort of last gasp before decolonization. So even if this isn't a massive scale operation, and it seemed like it was in Tanganyika and in Uganda, there was definitely resource investment and it definitely mattered. Then the consequences of thinking about African biopolitics mattered a lot. And then there's the question of more generally the European refugee experience as World War II bled into the Cold War or shifted into the Cold War. Obviously, they're very different stories, but I'm curious where you see the questions that you raise at the beginning of how race entangles with exile and immigration and colonialism really emerge from the story you've told of this moment where there were Polish refugees in Eastern and Central Africa.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for this. Let me just have to sort myself with this. I think. The first point you raised for the refugees themselves, I think, at least as far, I think for everyone, anyone who has ever experienced being forcefully displaced or been a refugee, that sticks for life and that increases the understanding for other people who experience the same in another context. But I think that's something... most definitely stuck with the people, and there's these there are memorial initiatives of people whose parents or grandparents had been refugees and who are now going there and renovating the cemeteries that are there, and they are always very thankful and. Yeah, try to reconnect with the people because it's like it's also a story of hospitality by all the critical viewing of it. It's. And then the impact on the colonial societies. I think I'm definitely sure that this was not the last like the punch that brought down colonial rule in Africa. But nevertheless, I think it could have well been at least a small contribution to let this image of white superiority, white prestige, or how it was perceived, like this image that the colonizers always were very keen on projecting or protecting and producing, reproducing that this through segregation, through all kinds of rituals and distancing, and this at least got some cracks in this image. And it was an image that was already, I mean, the whole Second World War contributed to this. So where you have soldiers from Africa fighting in Europe and seeing like, okay, they're the same here. So, and also the scene Britain severely weakened after the Second World War, actually, and France even more. That was in between an occupied country. So I think it could have contributed something there, a small contribution maybe, and also for this image of white people are always rich and always powerful, and then you, especially the people living around in this, because they were, these refugee camps were often really remote areas, and then suddenly you see, like, that was what I get from interviews with people. They said, like, okay, never seen before such a large group of so poor white people. So before that, white people were always few and always powerful and rich. So, and then there come 1,000 people who are like, look, not very rich and not very healthy, especially in the beginning. Yeah. So I think they could have made an impact on this. It's hard to measure things like this, but this, yeah.
Thank you. I want to talk about sources for just a moment as we move toward the end of the conversation. Obviously, you've gone to a lot of different types of source material. I'm always happy to see extensive oral history, and I like the methodological reflection on it toward the end of the book also. Partly, I guess it's a function of being aware that you want to include African voices and you know they're not documented as much. So the way that I'm going to ask this question intersects specifically with the Eastern European Studies audience I want to be sure to bring in here, which is, how would you, what kind of sources do you think are really crucial in order to be able to incorporate this story into larger narratives? I bring this up partly because in Polish history, for example, in the field of Polish studies, there have been some very important books lately by University of Wisconsin professor Catherine Siancia about the interwar Poland's attempts to civilize the Kresy, or by Piotr Puchalski. He just published Poland in a Colonial World Order, which is really about interwar Poland's colonial imaginary that was never fulfilled, and several other books. So there's a conversation in the field of Eastern European studies already, but it's not the same conversation that you're having. They overlap, I think, in really important ways, and I'd be curious what you think about the kinds of sources you read that could speak to a broader conversation about where, whether it's Poles or Eastern Europeans, but basically, aside from the usual story of the Brits and the French, we can think more productively at the intersection of European and African history.
Okay, what sources? I mean, yeah, as you said, I rely in this book on quite a range of different sources I found at different places. So yeah, in the National Archives in Kenya and in Tanzania. So these are the colonial administration on the ground sources. And then I've been to London, to the National Archives, and to archives of the former Polish exile government in London, and to the UN organization's archives, that is, of the IRO, it's in Paris, and of the UN, it's in New York. So of the UNRWA, it's in New York, although they closely follow up in each other, but they're different places. I think what I can bring into the in the debate in Eastern European studies, what I think is a really important debate, and I read at least some parts of it and engage with it in one chapter of the book, where and they are mainly relying on Polish sources, obviously. So, and that's very important, and it's good that people do this. But I think that what I, coming from African studies, try to bring in here is also to say, okay, bringing in African perspectives on people of Polish people and British people in Africa. So I think that's what I can bring in here, because especially, yeah, I mean, there are many, much more written sources from Poland about the Polish colonial attempts or Polish travelers to Africa or missionaries. So there's quite some written sources there. What I've tried in my book is also to bring in the African perspectives there, at least as far as it is possible. As you said, like it's oral history always has its limitations, and but at least and I think what's another really interesting Polish source that I used, but not everything that is there is Polish newspapers that were printed in published in Kenya, published by the refugees and the refugee administration, and so these give contemporary perspectives from an not only elite point of view, partly as well, but also from common writer people from the camps who were sending in letters there. So I think that's a fascinating source in their archives in London, of all places. And I looked at a fraction of this because there were quite some newspapers and published every week over years. So yeah, I think that brings in an interesting perspective there from Africa, but Polish perspective there.
Well, there's a contemporary resonance to the question also in that, I mean, you've alluded to this a couple of times. It's hard for me as the host of a podcast in the spring of 2022, talking with you, an expert on migration and refugees, not to talk at least for a moment about Ukraine, and in particular because there are so many Ukrainians specifically in Poland today. But then again, as you had mentioned, until the past month or so, it would have been more likely to think about Africa or the Middle East if we were thinking, if we said the word refugees, and if we were thinking about refugees moving toward Europe. So the reason why I bring this up is I'm curious, and not to put you on the spot, but if you see, or if you've been thinking about in recent weeks, any lessons that you saw in the administration of the refugee experience. And it struck me, for example, there was that point, the strategic point that you identified, why the Brits wanted Polish refugees out of the way from Iran. Well, because it was a strategic area of interest. And I think about Eastern Poland, and I think about that as well. Obviously, that's just one element. But I'm curious, your look at what's going on in Eastern Europe today, at the Russian invasion and its consequences. What do you think about in terms of your book? Because I'm sure there are a lot of thoughts that you have.
Definitely. I mean, actually, most of the people came from what is now Ukraine and Belarus. So that's the very same. They came from what is now Lviv, then Lvov. So so people came from the same places even. And I think as an historian of someone in refugee history, it's not new that Europeans are fleeing. I mean, the whole UN system was set up to deal with the Europeans who were there displaced after the Second World War. So that's more that I think like, okay, yeah, we've been here before. So, and that's also what came up, what I realized there was an interest in this story coming up here and there of people who say like, okay, now Europeans are fleeing. So, and also of Africans who are saying like, okay, now they start the war there. Maybe they come back because they've been here before. The people who then remember these stories. So, I think that's like this one takeaway point. Okay, it can happen anywhere and people always have to flee war. So, as sad as it is. So, the other thing is what I realized from this is also that not all refugees are treated the same. So I mean that's the whole debate about the refugee reception of Ukrainians because they are from the neighboring country and they are white and they are, well, at least now they are considered white. They were not always considered white, but there's this great hospitality which is wonderful. And really great and So there's nothing to say, nothing bad about it. It's just at the same time, you see other people from Syria fleeing a war that, like, being from cities that were bombed by the same bombers. So actually, but they are not allowed in. They are pushed back on the border. So, and that's again, that's what happened before. So it's an ideal that all refugees should be treated equally, or all humans should be treated equally. But it's in fact, it's always when there's a common interest, when there's a commonality felt there. I mean, it's also a point that comes in there. There's this interest. There's a common enemy. So, and it's very clear who's the aggressor here in the Ukraine. So it's clear that everyone in Europe, or at least everyone with some sense, says like, okay, we have to help these people because, yeah. But it's different when it's wars where it's not so clear who is a bad guy. If you take civil wars in, I don't know, in the Congo or so, then from Europe, it's not so clear, okay, why should I help this one and not this one? Because it's complicated. I don't know about it. So, yeah. But I think that's, yeah, this strategic interest is important, and also the generally different treatment of refugees. That's sadly, it's all not very surprising. So that's sometimes what you learn from history. That's like, okay, we have been here before somehow.
And in that sense, I think it's all the more important to read books like yours, because we do see certain mistakes, hopefully, that can be avoided, and likewise empathize in other ways with the experience of those you've written about. I have to bring our conversation to a close, but I wanted to ask you one last question, which is, I'm sure our audience would like to know what's next for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much for, first of all. Currently, I'm, as you said in the beginning, I'm working in a research project on the history of refugee camps, and that connects to this story, because these were people in refugee camps in the 40s and 50s in Africa. But I broaden this scope a bit, and I'm working on Greek refugees who'd been to the Belgian Congo. That's what I just recently wrote about. And I want to, and I'm working on other camps of UNRWA and, you know, of UNRWA in the Middle East, where Yugoslav and Greek refugees came. So just to show, okay, this is, it's not just the Polish group of Polish refugees, but there were others. And that was a crucial time where refugee camps evolved. And they did not only involve in post-war Europe, but they also evolved during wartime in Africa. So that's mainly what I'm working on. I'm also trying, as part of this project, to work on the further history of refugee hosting in Uganda, of refugees from Rwanda who came just 8 years after the Poles left. Although this was stopped during the pandemic, so I still have to pick up on this project, but that's broadly what I'm working on now. So writing.
Well, that's a wonderful variety of different directions under the auspices of the same project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I wanted to remind everyone and recommend to everyone Jochen Lingelbach's recent work On the Edges of Whiteness, Polish Refugees in British Colonial Africa During and After the Second World War. It's a great read and an important book. It came out in 2020 with Berghahn Books. And Dr. Jochen Lingelbach has been my guest today on New Books in Eastern European Studies. Thank you again.
Yeah, thank you so much, Pierre. It was really great conversation, and thank you so much for these great questions and comments. And yeah, thank you so much. It was really nice.
Thank you.